everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for all of you today. Grace Gershony will be returning to the show to talk to us about the third edition of her book, Organic Revolutionary. And I'm really excited to have her on, and I'll tell you more about Grace when she comes on in just a little bit. But first, I want to share with you things going on in and around the news, ways that you can take action, and, of course, share with you my weekly recipe. So, of course, the big news this week and the very sad news this week was the passing of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And not only is my heart broken, but, you know, half the country, the half of the country that I connect with is heartbroken and really scared about the prospects of Trump being able to select the new Supreme Court justice. It can change the trajectory of our country as we know it going forward. And it's really, really a very scary prospect. And yet it's something that we all have to deal with. It's just, you know, it's terrible. And if you look at the nominees that he is considering, even though they are women that resemble The Handmaid's Tale. I mean, it's just, it's really, really scary. I actually purchased a Handmaid's Tale costume, so the next time I go on a climate march, I can wear my costume. And I have a picture, actually, of my daughter yesterday down in D.C. wearing her Handmaid's Tale costume opposite the steps of the Supreme Court where Justice Ginsburg was laying out. And it's just a really, really scary time, and we just need to work together to get people out to vote. And we can't become complacent. We need to become active citizens if we want to take the reins and have any power in controlling the direction that this country goes. And so it's important that we get all the disenfranchised people that very often don't vote out there to vote, because those are the ones that will vote for Biden as opposed to Trump. And I really hate to talk politics here, but we just really, really need to. I was reading this article on biodiversity and the loss of biodiversity that is happening on the globe. Globally, we are just losing thousands and thousands, if not millions, of species, plant species, animal species. The diversity, we're just losing it. And, you know, when the balance of nature is taken out of balance, so many things happen, which we can see a perfect display of that with the pandemic going on right now, with the wildfires going on, with the increased number and power of the hurricanes that are coming in. And all of this is impacted by the burning of fossil fuels and what we do and what humans create in nature. And so we have to stop the burning of fossil fuels. We have to really change what we're doing. And, you know, 10 years ago, there was the Convention of Biological Diversity, where almost every country in the world signed on to make a commitment to change the way that they farm and the way that they fish, because, and also the burning of fossil fuels. And yet, no one has met the target, not one country. And our country didn't even sign on. We are one of the few, and yet we create more greenhouse gas emissions, I think, than any other country, maybe next to China. So we really, really need to change our administration and get people in there that realize the crisis that humanity is facing and really wants to do something about it. And so I just want to encourage everybody to take action. You know, this past weekend, on Sunday, there was the Climate Justice Through Racial Justice March in New York City, which is a kickoff to Climate Week, which is going on this whole week. And on my website, I have lists of what's going on for Climate Week, but you can also Google it and find out things that are going on in your area to participate in Climate Week. But anyway, the climate justice through racial justice march was beautiful. The signs were beautiful. The people that were there are beautiful, but there just wasn't enough people. There should have been thousands, if not millions of people. We're in New York City. And there was just, you know, maybe 1,000 people tops, just not enough people. And we really need people to wake up and to take action and to get passionate about this. And one thing that is really nice, and I remember talking to a friend a long time ago, how they keep positive and how they keep doing the work that they're doing. And they said, by doing the work, by doing humanitarian work, by doing environmental work, by doing justice, racial justice work, by getting out there and doing work and surrounding yourself by others doing work, you at least feel like you're doing something, that you're just not sitting back and allowing the destruction to happen all around you. And so it's a way to feel empowered and to feel hopeful. and, you know, there are many different examples of hope that are going on around the world. You know, I had Brian Tokar last week, and he, you know, in his book, he wrote about all these different things going on. Frances Moore Lappe has been on, and she's talked about it. And there's just so many examples of people doing good things around the world to make things better. But we really need the governments to step up, because they create the most damage, and their policies, the policies that governments set, are the ones that can really make the big change. So we all have to work together to make this change happen. So please, next time you hear of a march, please show up, get out there, write letters, get people out to vote, do what you can. Right now on my website, I have a petition that I'm asking you all to sign to support the Future Generations Protection Act. And this is an act that Jan Schakowsky and Congresswoman Nanette Barragan introduced. That it's an anti-fossil fuel bill that would ban greenhouse gas emissions from all new power plants, stop hydraulic fracking, and ban crude oil and natural gas exports. And the exports are the reason we, you know, these big oil companies are pushing so much for these pipelines, because they're, you know, they're now extracting all this new oil and gas, and they want to export it all for their profit, and yet the damage we all have to live with. It's just an unfair situation. So please support the Future Generations Protection Act. And there's also a petition to stop the sale of GMO salmon. I mean, I've had this up before, but now it's really getting close to hitting the market. And there's, of course, going to be no labeling. You know, some stores like Whole Foods and I even think Walmart, you know, signed on to say that they would not purchase GMO salmon. But big food corporations like Aramark and Compass, who run so many of the restaurants and food service institutions around the country, they are right up there ready to get this salmon. And it won't be labeled, and you won't know you're eating it. So please sign this petition, and let's see if we can make a change there. I want to share with all of you my recipe this week, which is a kale, Swiss chard, and mushroom pie. One of my family's favorite dishes was my spinach pie recipe, which I have to say was loaded with feta cheese, and I even put Gruyere cheese in it. Sometimes I'd even put mozzarella cheese. So it was really a cheese and spinach pie. And, of course, the layers of the phyllo pastry were brushed with originally, when I first started making it, just butter, and then years ago I cut it where I did half butter and half oil. But still, it was, you know, a big dish of deliciousness, but filled with dairy. And now that I am vegan and don't eat dairy anymore, and yet still I'm cooking for my family, I wanted to recreate this dish to be just as delicious, but to be dairy-free. So this kale, Swiss chard, and mushroom pie, of course, can be made with spinach, but spinach is not growing in my garden right now, and I have loads of kale and Swiss chard. So if you steam the Swiss chard and kale before using it, you can really wilt it down so that it's, you know, it reduces in volume. You squeeze all the water out of it, and then you measure it from there. So let me read the ingredients to you, and then I'll talk you through the recipe. But it was really a winner, and I hope you all get to make it. So I started with one package of phyllo pastry, and the phyllo factory pastry is actually an organic one, so I recommend that one highly. 3 cups of cooked greens, kale, Swiss chard, you can use spinach if you're buying it, that you're going to cook and pack it down, squeeze the water out, and then pack it down and measure 3 cups. 2 cups of mushrooms, also measured after you cook them. So actually, that's not true. I measured the mushrooms before cooking them, but I cooked them really well done. And I had a mixture of portobello, oyster, shiitake, really any mushrooms will work. 2 tablespoons of sherry wine or Marsala wine or even a red wine would work. A splash of tamari. I tried for the very first time a vegan feta cheese that was really quite good. I think you can make it and even leave this feta cheese out because once it was cooked, I wasn't that aware that the feta cheese was even in there. But I did use this vegan feta cheese. 1 bunch of fresh dill. 1 large onion chopped, 1/2 cake of tofu, 3 tablespoons of unsweetened milk alternative, 2 handfuls of uncooked organic white rice. You can use a jasmine rice. I used organic basmati rice. Brown rice doesn't cook quick enough in the casserole. So if you use brown rice, you're going to have hard pieces of rice in your dish. So I really recommend using a white rice for this dish. 1/3 cup of olive oil. And sprinkle of salt flakes, such as Maldon salt flakes. And if you're not familiar with Maldon salt flakes, you want to be. They are just great. And it's a finishing salt that you add on at the end, but in this dish you can sprinkle it on and you'll just get little bites of saltiness the way you would from feta cheese. So you start by blanching or steaming the greens until wilted, and then you put them into an ice bath, and that locks in the bright green color. If you don't do that, you know, the greens kind of turn olive green. It just changes the color of the dish. So you're going to drain out, once you do that, drain the greens and squeeze out all the water and then measure out the 3 cups. Before you do that, actually, cut the greens into small pieces. So you squeeze the greens out and you'll have big clumps of greens. They just stay like a fistful of greens. And then just chop that so it's like chopped spinach would be. And then measure 3 cups. And put it into a large bowl. And then in a food processor, you're going to pulse the tofu with the milk alternative until well blended. Add a couple pinches of salt to that, and then add that to the bowl of greens. Saute the onions until they're translucent, and add that to the bowl of greens. And then using the same pan, saute the mushrooms in a little bit of olive oil until they're really well done. Once they start getting seared, then you can add the sherry and the tamari, and you're going to cook it again until all the liquid is absorbed and they're really, the mushrooms become really very flavorful. They become the umami that you're adding to this dish. And then you're going to add those mushrooms to the bowl of greens. Then add 2 handfuls of rice to the bowl and mix that up. Spray the bottom of your Pyrex pan with some olive oil. Open the phyllo pastry. And the phyllo pastry, if you haven't worked with phyllo pastry before, you want to work relatively quickly. You can put a damp cloth on top of the phyllo pastry if you're not moving that quickly. But I find that I'm moving quick enough that I don't even bother with the damp cloth. But the phyllo pastry, comes stacked in a rectangle. I don't know the exact measurements, but my guess would be it's larger than the 9x13 pan that I'm recommending you use. So you can either trim the phyllo down, or you can use it the size that it is and then trim it afterwards. I usually trim it beforehand so that it fits into the pan. And I put a sheet of phyllo down, and then I brush some olive oil on it. You can use a pastry brush, but I actually have a paintbrush that I've designated as my pastry brush, so it's more like 3 inches wide so that I can really work fast. And you want to brush each sheet of phyllo pastry with some olive oil. And, of course, I don't want the pastry soaking in olive oil. So it's a really thin coat of olive oil that you're going to put onto each sheet of pastry. And there's about 20 sheets of phyllo pastry in a pack, and so you're going to put 10 on the bottom and 10 on the top. So you brush each sheet with phyllo pastry. Once you have 8 or 10 sheets on the bottom, then you're going to spread the kale, Swiss chard, mushroom filling on top. Then I am going to take the vegan feta cheese, and I dice that up into little pieces, and I sprinkled that on top. I didn't want to mix it in with the whole dish because I thought it might just disappear, and I didn't want to use too much of it. So I just put it on the top, and then I sprinkled a little bit of the malt and salt on top because the vegan feta cheese is not as salty as the regular feta cheese. And then I pushed it into the spinach just a little bit so that the surface of the spinach, not the spinach, the kale and Swiss chard was even. And then I started with the phyllo on top again. One sheet, brushing it with the olive oil, then another sheet, and repeated until all the phyllo was used up. I trimmed the phyllo that's hanging over the edge of the pan. And then you want to score the phyllo before you cook it. You can cut it all the way through, but you don't necessarily have to cut it all the way through. But you do want to score at least the top phyllo sheet so that once it's cooked and you're cutting it, you're not going to crumble the phyllo into small little pieces. You'll be able to just go right through where you've scored it. So you're going to score it into portion sizes, and then bake it in a 350 or 375 degree oven. You know your oven. You're going to bake it until it's golden brown, which takes about 50 minutes. If it's starting to get too dark, if the back of your oven, you can turn the pan around, or you can cover the whole thing with some aluminum foil to keep it from getting too dark. And then you remove it and serve it right out of the oven. It's delicious. It also freezes really well, so that if you make a larger pan, very often I'm making it in a chafing pan, making it a little larger. You just, double the quantity of what you need and make a big chafing pan of it, and then you can freeze portions into the freezer, and it's great down the road. So enjoy the recipe. I love feedback. Share with me what you think. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you Grace Gershenny. She is the author of Organic Revolutionary, a memoir of the movement for real food, planetary healing, and human liberation. And she's widely known as an author, an educator, and an organic consultant. In the 1990s, she served on the staff of the U.S. Department of Agriculture's National Organic Program, where she helped write the regulations. She learned much of what she knows through her longtime involvement with the grassroots organic movement, where she organized conferences and educational events and developed an early organic certification program for NOFA, the Northeast Organic Farming Association, which I'm on the board of my local New York chapter. And she's a reformed market gardener. She's still growing her own vegetables and raising chickens in Vermont. And she's teaching right now at the Green Mountain College, the online Master's in Sustainable Food System program, and she serves on the board of the Institute for Social Ecology. She has a Master's in Extension Education from the University of Vermont with a self-designed concentration in ecological agriculture. And Grace works as an independent organic inspector and a consultant for private and nonprofit clients through her services that she calls Gaia Services. And she helps her clients with all aspects of organic certification, developing related standards and certification systems and training programs. And so it's my pleasure to introduce all of you to Grace. Grace, are you with me?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm here, Bhavani. I've been listening attentively to your preliminary comments and
Great.
Appreciate them.
Thank you.
I think, just to make a small correction, I'm no longer, Green Mountain College no longer exists.
Oh, no. Okay.
Are
you still teaching anywhere?
I am just doing online teaching for the Institute for Social Ecology, which I'm still on the board of. And the other major commitment and work I'm doing is to be on the board of the Vermont Healthy Soils Coalition. And we are doing some online teaching and online work now, actually just starting to gear up to organize a series of presentations in the spring of 2021 through Vermont Healthy Soils Coalition. So that's kind of the update.
Thank you. Okay. So, well, I love your book. You know, I had the original, and now you have, this is your third edition. Can you share with us what inspired you to rewrite the book? Well, not rewrite the whole book, but come out with the new edition.
Yeah, well, I appreciated your introductory comments about politics and the pandemic and the climate crisis and the species extinction crisis, because those are all big parts of what inspired an update to the book. And in fact, it's great that you brought my good friend and colleague Brian Tokar on the show last week?
Yes.
Yeah, Brian and I have been working together for many years. We're both on the board of the Institute for Social Ecology. And Brian wrote the new foreword for the third edition of my book.
Oh, really? Okay. Uh-huh.
Yes. And so we have been working together actually for a number of years trying to pull together an online course for the Social Ecology Online program on climate justice and food justice. And we've both just been so busy with other things and other activist projects and education projects that, you know, it has kept falling to the back burner. But
yeah, well, there's no shortage of things for us grassroots activists to be involved in, right? I mean,
right,
the world is falling apart right in front of our eyes. And the complacency with so many people is just amazing. I mean,
yes,
it's just going to take everybody to get to the streets to like become involved, because there's only one planet. I mean, there is no planet B, and this planet A is really going down the tubes at a very, very fast rate.
Well, and that's exactly. I mean, you're exactly right in where you find hope. Where people like me find hope is in staying involved and staying active. And when I got through writing this book, which took me 15 years from the time I left USDA until I finally ended up self-publishing it in 2016. I looked at that as kind of, well, this is putting a period on my phase of being directly very closely engaged with the organic movement. I wanted to step back and be kind of an elder and be more, you know, just a writer. And teaching, and you know, I felt like that was a good niche for me. But as you know, the things have changed a great deal in the past 4 years. And
it's amazing. It's speeding up in the wrong direction.
And certainly the election of 2016, when I was really out there pushing to get the word out about my book, it was devastating. And I did a little bit of revision and update the following year just to to correct some errors in the copy and to increase a little bit of my recognition of the new and very heartening rise of people of color as in leadership and getting involved in agriculture more seriously, and people like Leah Penniman at Soulfire Farm, and who I was very, very inspired by. And so I just wanted to acknowledge and hope that people like me, who have been the leaders in the previous generation, and in which really the organic movement was, I think, rightfully perceived as kind of elitist and white and purist, we were able to pass the torch to more activist, justice-oriented leaders. And I think that's really, really happening. And all over, the explosion of interest in amongst people of color and, you know, not gender nonconforming people of really reclaiming their agricultural heritage and looking at things like land sharing and reparations and food sovereignty. And those are all things that I have encouraged and worked to learn more about and to really lift up those voices to the extent possible. And of course, where I live in Vermont, unfortunately, is extremely not white. and people of color.
Wait, you're saying where you live is not white?
No,
it is white.
Is extremely missing the non-white culture.
Right,
it's
exactly.
Very white.
Uh-huh. Yes, Vermont is very white.
Yes, and people of color in leadership positions have been emerging and finding themselves getting harassed and finding that there really is a very strong and troubling racist viewpoint and in Vermont, and a lot of people who are struggling to better understand what's going on and to make amends and to learn and to really find a way to make our place more welcoming, because we see that there will be incredible disruptions in climate related and politically related disruptions. We've already seen that with terrible consequences, as you've noted, and we want to make it possible for people to come here and find refuge and safety and an opportunity to participate in what is really a growing and stronger and stronger community resilience, food sovereignty, local food movement.
I find it so surprising to hear you say that, you know, that the racist viewpoint is prevalent in Vermont, because I think of Vermont, even though it is white, very white, you know, just happens more like it just happens to be, but because Vermont is so liberal and is so on track in so many other ways, you know, with farm to school movement and, you know, food issues that I'm so passionate about, you know, I would think that the racist issue would not be so prevalent there. So
we'd like to believe that, but it isn't.
Right.
It's still a problem, and that is sometimes people feel like, oh, well, it's not a problem in Vermont because we're so liberal, but it is a problem. And
an awful lot
of unconscious racism and unwitting belief that, you know, when people put out Black Lives Matter signs, you get blowback. Well, all lives matter. What are you doing? And
right.
You know,
well, I had a sign on my front lawn that was taken, you know, it wasn't just Black Lives Matter, but it was All Lives Matter and Human Rights Matter and Women Matter. And, you know, it was one of those signs that I'm sure you've seen around, multicolored and very pretty. And it was taken, and I couldn't believe it. So I ordered, you know, a couple more so that if it gets taken again, I have another one. But the one I have out now has been there for a couple of months and hopefully will not be taken.
A lot has changed in the last few years, and in particular, you know, I got more kind of really tired of the same old debates in the organic community, and I'll talk a little bit more about that, and became, you know, more engaged with my more radical and revolutionary side, and determined that I once Green Mountain College closed down, and it is now the master's program that I was teaching in is now part of Prescott College in Arizona, which is great, and a lot of the same folks are working with it. And I actually used to teach in through the Prescott College distance program for the social ecology program. So it's all good. And I'm happy to not be in the academic treadmill.
Right now, for sure.
And
I'd like to talk with you a little bit.
Now I'm on Social Security, and I don't have to be.
Well, that's good. That's good.
Scraping.
I wanted to talk to you with your, your knowledge about our current food system and how that is interrelated with the climate chaos, the pandemic, racial injustice. I mean, I know you were just touching a little bit on that, but, you know, I think people don't really realize how much our food system affects the climate crisis. So maybe we could talk a little bit about that.
Well, certainly, you know, that has been a major part of why I have continued to get out there and speak and teach and organize because I have learned more and more about how integral the modern food system is to the evolution of the climate crisis and how integral the food system is to solving or at least mitigating the climate crisis. I don't think we're past the point of no return in terms of going back to the way things were in terms of the climate, but we can still do a great deal through the way we manage land and through the way the food system works to mitigate it. And I'm not just talking about carbon emissions, although carbon emissions are extremely important in all of the ways in which the food system depends on fossil fuel use, from, you know, transportation to refrigeration to all of those different, industrial processing and industrial machines that are needed for agriculture, but also through the destruction of soil. And that is really one of the key ways that I got involved in the organic movement to begin with, is because of my interest in learning about soil. And actually the first book I ever wrote was called The Soul of Soil, and it's still in print from Chelsea Green, so I'll put in a little plug for that. And it's considered a classic, and because it really looked at soil management from a practical as well as an ecological bigger picture system. And today there is a really increasing understanding of the possibility of actually reversing climate change through building healthy soil, and that's the big part of the message of the Vermont Healthy Soils Coalition that I mentioned. So what I just watched, for example, this new film out that's now on Netflix called Kiss the Ground.
Oh, you've seen it. I haven't seen it yet. Uh-huh.
Yeah, I recommend watching it. The one caveat that I find still disturbing about this movement is that the emphasis is so much on, you know, privileged white guys who are coming to save us, you know.
Right. Yeah, right? I think we had a little bit of that with the beautiful film that was like Big Farm, Little Farm, or what was that?
Yeah.
I forget the name of it, but something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah. I know that film, and I had the same response to it. It,
mm-hmm.
it was a beautiful example of what you can do with unlimited money.
right, which is most people's reality. So not most
right.
people's reality. Uh huh. Right.
And,
yeah. So the destruction of land. I mean, they're destroying the rainforest, and a lot of that is not only for going in and doing fracking and doing that kind of stuff, but it's also for grazing animals and raising animals. And
well,
so, and the forests, for those, not aware, absorbs so much of that carbon emissions that you were talking about earlier and helps mitigate it and puts it back into the soil. And,
right.
you take down all those trees, you don't have that.
Right. Well, I have to say that there's a lot of mythology about livestock and the role of livestock. Certainly industrial livestock, which is what we're talking about, is a big problem. But it's not the grazing that's the problem. It's the raising of the crops. It's the raising of the row crops like soybeans and corn that are the big destroyers of soil. Grazing animals actually can be raised in ways that actually help build soil and help reverse climate change. And that is a huge message in Kiss the Ground as well. And I think that that's one of the flashpoints that ends up becoming creating a great deal of misunderstanding and difficulty internally in the movement. And I think that we need to do a lot more to learn to see what the differences are and to practice some kind of level of tolerance internally. This is, again, one of the key things that has kept me involved is the need for better unity within our very diverse, very diverse in terms of our different ways of seeing the world movements.
Well, I think you're talking about like regenerative agriculture, where yes, grazing animals on a smaller scale as a organic farmer might do, or a regenerative farmer might do, is different. But when you're tearing down the rainforest to graze millions of animals,
down the rainforest isn't they may be grazing animals as a beginning, as a prelude, because that's the best way to clear the land for the purpose of growing the crops. And
uh-huh.
most of the destruction comes from the crop growing, not the grazing animals.
Mm-hmm.
It is definitely wrong to cut down the rainforest for anything.
Any reason,
know.
Right.
Any reason, you know, whatever extractive industry you want to name, it's wrong to cut it down, and it's incredibly destructive. But the idea that there's some, that, you know, that animals per se are the problem is the wrong approach. And
yeah.
It's not just...
Well, I know animals can help rebuild the soil. So I know, you know, if you're talking about regenerative agriculture, you know, you can use animals in a very productive way as well to help build back the soil.
Actually, I would argue that it is virtually impossible to have a sustainable regenerative agriculture without livestock.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is, I think that that's something that needs to be understood better. Whether you think about the livestock in terms of the livestock that are naturally wild present, which have been eliminated in our modern system, that's, you know, you can farm without raising domestic animals, but you're still going to want manure from somewhere. You're still going to want to raise the kind of crops that are soil building and permanent, which are generally hay and forage for animals. And you are, you know, in Vermont in particular, you're going to be farming land that you don't ever want to have tilled up. Soil tillage is one of the most destructive things that is releasing carbon from the soil and the atmosphere, destroying the communities of microorganisms that build soil, that feed plants, that feed us. And the microorganisms in the soil are very analogous to the microorganisms in our bodies. And I'm sure you know about the inner microbiome and how important it is. And it's very analogous to the soil microbiome. So tilling the soil disrupts the mycorrhizal fungi, which are responsible really for the community of plants and the feeding of plants from otherwise inaccessible minerals, and lots and lots of new research is coming out about how crucial these communities are and how much they do to maintain the viability of the soil. And another piece that I've been learning more and more about, thanks to some programs and workshops given by people like Walter Yane, an Australian soil ecologist and hydrologist, is the role of the soil community in regulating the water cycle. And that is also given some attention in the Kiss the Ground movie. So I really encourage people to watch that movie with the understanding that much of that knowledge that wonderful people like Alan Savory and Paul Hawken and others other white guys that they're featuring in this movie was learned from indigenous people's methods, and you know, the whole permaculture movement is known to be basically borrowing ideas from indigenous cultures that worked with natural systems and their environment to make fertility and to create productive agroecosystems. So that's my little rant about that. You know, soil building is key not just for not just for sequestering carbon, but also for managing the water cycles and cooling the planet. Without the planetary cooling that we need to do, all of the carbon reduction in the world is not going to keep us from heating up and heating up into the future. One other thing, and this really relates to my continued advocacy for organic farming, even on an industrial scale. And I don't think that scale, you know, people on the one hand say, oh, big is bad, and then they say, well, this is a good idea, but can we scale it up? So we do need more people working the land. We need a lower ratio of eyes to acres. But we also need much more rapid conversion of farmland to organic management. And for example, there was just an announcement of the winning of organic certification by a 10,000 acre, no, I think it was bigger than that, 30,000 acre ranch in the Dakotas, which was transitioned over 3 years using a very competent consulting firm to organic for the purpose of producing the ingredients needed, the grains and wheat and mostly those parts of Annie's organic products, which are, of course, owned by General Mills. And this is certainly possible on a large scale, and having large herds of animals working the land is central to Alan Savory's method of holistic management. And in fact, the understanding that the fertility of the Great Plains that was built up over millennia by the presence of huge herds of bison moving around under pressure from predation. And there's, you know, reams and reams of information about that, and many people practicing holistic managed grazing who are building soil with the help of the livestock, in large numbers of livestock.
Yeah. You know, it's always challenging for grassroots organizations or smaller startups who end up getting bought out by the likes of General Mills, like Annie's, and yet it's the big corporations that have the money to help invest and help transition a 30,000 acre ranch towards organic. You know, Ann Arbor Bush, you know, last year had come out with a program to help farmers transition to organic to grow organic hops and barley for organic beer, because the organic beer movement is really, you know, has been taking off, and there's not enough organic hops and everything else that goes into it too. And so it's these big companies that are looking to change over that very often can support it. And, you know, it's a bit of a catch-22, because you don't necessarily want to take the money from big corporations, but at the same time, they're the ones that have the money to support this. And any land being transitioned to organic is a strike in the right, you know, in the right direction, you know. So
yeah, and I wanted to, you know, also mention the other piece about organic that people don't understand is that the requirements do not allow for monoculture. You know, the requirements do not allow for damaging the soil. And, you know, the overarching rule, and this, of course, gets into why I went to Washington to help write the rules. And I wrote most of the, I'm pretty much largely responsible for the whole section on soil management in the rules, and I stand by it. It could have been better, but it is, it requires that anything that is done on any organic operation, even a manufacturing operation, must maintain or improve the natural resource base of the operation. And that natural resource base includes the soil, the health of the soil, the water quality, biodiversity. Those are all spelled out in the rules.
Yeah, but then how did people justify making hydroponic organic? That's the whole problem. That's the whole reason, you know, we're looking at, you know, other types of certification, you know, the real organic movement. And
That's a whole other thing, and I don't want to get too involved in that discussion because my blood pressure rises a lot. But, you know, that is really a mistaken notion that there is no such thing, there can be no such thing as organic hydroponics. Those who are certified as organic are following the rules. They are not using harmful chemicals. They are introducing biodiversity, not enough, but introducing some. And, you know, the issue with them that people like my old friend and colleague Dave Chapman, who I have probably interviewed, have, is that they're huge scale basically industrial methods make them able to produce this crop very cheaply. It's not as high quality as one would get from soil grown. I can't even believe that it could possibly be, but that's not a requirement that the crops be the highest possible quality. If it were, then there'd be an awful lot of organic farmers who wouldn't make the grade. So the issue really is market competition, and even though that is denied by folks like Dave, at the bottom, that's what it's about, and the question of, for example, lumping aquaponics with, you know, industrial hydroponics is a misnomer, you know, and these guys campaign against aquaponics as much as hydroponics. In an inner city, you know, urban agriculture and food systems, aquaponics has become extremely popular, and it is completely, you know, feasible to be done on larger scales. I wouldn't go with industrial, you know, I don't like the idea of the industrial scale, but I don't think that it is, you know, evil. I think that it's good and it's better as long as it's not polluting and it's creating products that are not full of toxic substances and not endangering the workers who work in them. And so forth, not endangering.
So I'm a little confused. So are you saying that you think hydroponics qualify as organic?
Yes.
You do? Uh-huh.
Yep.
Even though it's not improving the soil, and it has no soil component at all?
Well, that's, you know, there's a lot of rules that the law requires that an operation maintain or improve the natural resource base of the operation. If there isn't soil being used, you're at least not damaging the soil that's under it. You know, there are a lot of gray areas, and there's also requirements, all kinds of requirements about managing livestock, but you don't have to have livestock on your farm.
Mm-hmm.
But if you do have livestock, then you have to manage them according to the rules. So, you know, it's a gray area for sure. And honestly, most of the hydroponic organic production is really high-end stuff that, you know, high-priced organic fruits and berries, primarily some, and tomatoes, of course, that are sold nationally distributed in, you know, little plastic clamshells, primarily in the off season. And I always argue that, you know, if you want organic, the best organic food, you should eat in season what's available, and if you want it off season, get frozen or freeze it. The nutritional quality is maintained, and you're not, you know, supporting these industrial hydroponic systems, which, you know, again, they're elite markets. Ordinary people can't afford to buy those clamshells of blueberries for, you know, $5 a half pint.
I know, it's unbelievable, isn't it? They're so expensive.
Right. So, you know, and it is by no means, you know, the huge monster of that folks like Dave make it out to be. It's a small segment of the whole organic market. You know, maybe $1 billion worth of retail sales, but the entire organic market has surpassed $55 billion and counting on retail sales.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, and I don't want to lose,
just, you know, being able to distinguish, you know, if someone's buying organic and someone, you know, you're paying top dollar and you want the nutrients that and the microorganisms that in part their magic into the vegetable, you want to know if you're buying organic that it has that. And, you know, so I think it's more just knowing whether it's organically grown in soil or hydroponic. I mean, I definitely appreciate that it's, you know, that they're not using pesticides and herbicides, and in that way they're not creating
and they're not using synthetic fertilizers, and that is another important piece that I think people don't understand or appreciate about the relationship of organic to the climate, is that synthetic nitrogen is one of the worst offenders in terms of the climate as well as damaging soil that we have, and it is completely forbidden for an organic producer, including hydroponic organic. They do not use synthetic fertilizers. What they do is, from what I understand, and I've never actually worked with an organic hydroponic producer, but I have learned a great deal about aquaponics from early development of the whole system at New Alchemy Institute, and I write about this in the book.
I'm just seeing the time, and we are just about out of time. I don't want to cut you off, Grace, but we are just about out of time. So I just would like to be able to share with everyone listening how they would find you on the web if they want to learn more about what you're doing.
Oh, sure. And I've been redoing my website, getting my website redone to reflect the book. and the website is organic-revolutionary.com.
Great.
And
great.
Find
Thank
ordering
you.
Information there. The new edition is published by Black Rose Books of Montreal, and with distribution in the U.S. through the University of Chicago Press.
Great. And I'll put those links on my website, too. So everyone listening, if you have been listening, I've been talking with Grace Gershany from her company or the work that she's doing through Gaia Services, and her book, Organic Revolutionary, a memoir of the movement for real food, planetary healing, and human liberation. Grace, thank you so much for your work. Keep it up. It's so important. And everyone out there listening, have a great rest of the week, and I'll see you all again next week. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green. Bye for now.